It is sunny and getting warmer here in the Chicago suburbs. It is March 7th, and this is Deanna Spingola. And as I mentioned, I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. I really appreciate you joining me today. I know Saturdays are kind of catch-up days and days that you go out and do errands. And so I really do appreciate you joining me here today at republicbroadcasting.org. I invite you to visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. During the program, you may email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email. You can visit our friendly chat room at spingola.chatango.com, where you may view our current and future guest lineup. Just click on the schedule button on the left-hand side of the page, and you can go all the way back to 2010. So remember, just visit spingola.com and choose the month and the appropriate day. Our first guest today, who I'm delighted to have back, we've talked with him not as often as we should have or could have, but we've had him on the program before, and I'm always delighted to talk to him and hear about, well, some of the things that have happened to him have not been, well, they've been pretty bad. And he's the author of a wonderful book. His name is Christopher Fogarty, and the his website is IrishHolocaust.org. He is the author of Ireland, 1845 to 1850, The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It Perfect. And that book is available from him, and you can order it direct, and I will give you the details, or he can give you the details when it comes on, which is right now. Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much, Deanna. I'm deeply grateful for you and your time. Thank you very, very much.
Well, I'm just, sometimes I think, gosh, I just talked to him, and then I look and find out, no, it's been a year and a half. Time goes by very quickly. It seems like when we were children, it just creeped by. But now, now it seems
to go at one time, a year was half our lives. Now it's only 1/80th of our lives.
Yes, it's just amazing how quickly time flies. Anyway, there have been, and I've mentioned this when we've talked in the past, the number of people who have died because of government policies, and we're often told that, well, those stupid Irish people were only eating potatoes, and when the potato blight struck, well, they just didn't have anything to eat, when in fact they created more, they had a population of, what was it, 8 or 9 million. They produced enough to feed 18 million people. But the English came in and, kind of took over everything, took the resources. And when we think about, people who have starved to death due to export policies, we'd have to go all the way back to, well, we would have to go back later than the so-called famine in Ireland, in 1877, almost 27 million people starved to death in India due to Britain's export policies. 3 million Filipinos died from smallpox following the U.S. invasion in 1898, where they received the smallpox vaccine, which was a disease that was unknown in the Philippines to that point. 7 million people starved in the Ukraine due to Stalin's first five-year plan, 3 million people in Bengal starved to death because of the policies of the Roosevelt-Churchill cabal during World War II. Over 170 million people were slaughtered by governments during the 20th century. 10 million died in World War I and 50 million died in World War II. Of those, the military killed during World War II, almost 70% were civilians. So when you think of all these people, and I believe it was Stalin said, one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic. A lot of people have died, have perished because of warfare, because of things like Agent Orange, which caused not only deaths but ongoing deformities. Abortion has killed 58 million infants under the guise of freedom of choice, which was kind of a remnant of the women's movement led by CIA asset Gloria Steinem. Then there were 500,000 children who died in Iraq due to U.S. sanctions. And I think, oh my gosh, this is really, really terrible. And it all seems to stem around government policies, warfare, and the resources. And then they have to do things that cover it up, including, well, CIA, FBI, these ABC agencies are designed to actually not investigate crimes, but to cover them up for the corporations that are and the governments who are doing all the killing and things that I just elaborated on. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I was listening to
you. Thought,
part of
you
the, one of the little aspects of that.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
One of the aspects of government crime is that the self-same FBI agent, Patrick, quote, Edward, unquote, Buckley, who framed me for the murder of the Langert family in Winnetka, but my life, at least my freedom, was saved by the actual murderer, who at 16 somehow got FBI agent Lewis's .357 Magnum and murdered that family. He saved me by blabbing through FBI agent Buckley's cover for him. David Biro, the 16-year-old, was the only suspect of the Winnetka Police Department the afternoon of the finding of the bodies. But the following day, FBI agent Buckley arrived on the scene, usurped investigatory authority, by the way, backed up by a letter from the U.S. Justice Department, and he prohibited the police from pursuing the murderer while he first of all got Carol Marin of the news medium Chicago,
oh, right,
the so-called conscience of Chicago news media, to put out the false word that there was an IRA connection to those murders, and then shortly after, FBI agent framed me so cunningly for those murders that I was doomed until the murderer blabbed through his cover, his FBI cover, into life without parole. He's now in Pontiac prison downstate.
Give us a little background about why why they would want to frame you, and what that was all about. Why would the FBI or anyone else attempt to frame you for a murder and go after you? Why would they do that?
Well, we really don't know. It remains a mystery to us, because the same FBI agent on the day that David Biro was convicted of two first-degree murders, a homicide and other things, he burst through our door here with a gang of guns-drawn agents and locked us up in the federal jail downtown Chicago, Clark and Van Buren, and tried to imprison us for the rest of our lives on a completely different, a different set of false charges, for which the only evidence was an FBI audio tape that he himself had criminally fabricated. Why he did all these things, I don't know, but I think perhaps my revelation about the genocide, a covered up genocide, the Irish Holocaust, I think that weighed very heavily in the decision to try to silence me. I think if they could do it over again, they would simply murder us.
So, there have been other people who have written about things that, that people took for granted or accepted, and they have also suffered some degree of, like you have. They've been threatened. They've been, all kinds of awful things have happened to them.
Some are in prison today. Some are in prison today.
Right.
Vinny just got out. Sterling, and then the major ones, the ones that have pointed out the most blatant crimes, the supreme crimes, the waging of a unprovoked war, they're in prison now. Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, and others, they're all in prison. So what we have is evidently a criminal regime. And we're hoping that the law-abiding people of the United States will wake up, because right now they're voting. The choice we have is quite poor. The choice of 2016 was between a not yet genocidist and a serial genocidist. And decent people, non-genocidists, will have to wake up and decide that the supreme crime is not quite apple pie American. That these are done in our name, these supreme crimes, and by the way, supreme crime is as defined by the Nuremberg Tribunal post-World War II, the waging of an unprovoked war. That is what we're engaged in the Middle East. And we know who is behind all of them, and they are now our spokespeople on television. So we have an awful lot of work to do. I was hoping that the first part of this show would be about the Irish Holocaust.
Yes.
And it turns out that what we were all taught in school was a genocide perpetrated that required more than half the British Army to perpetrate. All of this is completely written out of history. I would never know it myself, except that after finishing a job in El Salvador back in early 1980s, I thought I would like to learn about my father's father, my grandfather. I never knew him. He was dead in 1923, born in 1839. And so he was a British soldier. I've learned to be ashamed to say, except that his army pay was keeping his siblings alive in Ireland. They had been evicted by an English landlord from their holding in County Leash, then Queen's County. And that was usually a death sentence, to be evicted from your house and land. He and his family survived, and when he was 18, he walked to Abbey Leash and joined the British Army. As they say, took the Queen's shilling, to Queen Victoria's shilling, and on which his family, it was part of the way by which his family could survive. However, his sister collapsed and died between her house and the post office, looking for his army pay. So they were in dire need. And he kept them all alive except one who didn't quite make it. And so he worked for the British Empire in Australia, New Zealand, and India from 1857 to 1881. So I wanted to learn about him. And it was while doing his biography at the Public Record Office in Kew, Surrey, outside London, I found that the regiment that he joined when he was 18 in 1857, the 40th Regiment of Foot, when he was a little boy, had been removing the food from South County Galway to the port of Galway for export. I was stunned, because I believed everything I had been taught and had read. I knew there was something a little bit strange about the so-called famine, but I had no proof. So all of a sudden I find that the 40th of Foot had removed the food from South County Galway, and so I continued researching, and I found that more than half the British Army, 67 regiments of Britain's 130 regiment army, were in Ireland in those years, removing Ireland's abundant food crops at gunpoint. This is shocking information, has never been published before. My website and my pamphlet started out as a pamphlet, and hundreds of thousands of copies were made and distributed all over the world, actually. And then I put it up when the internet came up, I put it up there. And then when that didn't silence the big lie operatives, I decided to use their method, which is a book. And so the title of the book is Ireland 1845-1850, The Perfect Holocaust, and Who Kept It, quote, Perfect, unquote. Holocaust is how it was reported starting on the 4th of May, 1846, in the Irish Examiner. At the time it was the Cork, the County Cork Examiner. And they were the first recorded instance of the use of Holocaust regarding Ireland. But that newspaper repeatedly referred to it as Holocaust for the next 7 or 8 years, and so did other writers at the time, well-known writers such as Michael Davitt and James Fitzgerald and others, all referred to it as Holocaust. So we're not competitive with Jews or with those promoting the Nazi wrongdoing, but there's something in matters of labels that precedent usage develops some kind of a proprietary claim, or at least a primary right of usage. And so no one has any complaint about the Jews having abandoned the label Shoah back in the 1960s, and this is confirmed by Professor Norman Finkelstein. But they don't have a proprietary claim to it. It was first used regarding the British Holocaust of Ireland, and it was used starting in 1846. And 1846 is a little earlier than 1945 or 1960 when they made the changeover from Shoah to Holocaust. Again, no one has any complaint whatever about the Jewish use of the word Holocaust. But the Irish, it was used and applied to the Irish Holocaust 90-some years prior to it being used in the United States. So that's that. My book plows into all of it, is all new ground in that I think it'd be appropriate to just go over the contents of the book.
Absolutely, yes.
If we have time here now,
it's actually quite a thick book, and you have a map in the book that shows all the graves. Oh my gosh! Every time I look at this map.
It shows approximately 180 of the Holocaust mass graves in Ireland. My wife and I we're using the entire gross proceeds of this book to install memorials over those mass graves. The people of Ireland are too afraid to do so themselves. They come to us and ask us to install them because Ireland is a somewhat collectivist governmental enterprise. And the people see themselves as recipients of government aid, and they would not receive it if they were to expose this hidden genocide.
Right. Okay, we will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us, folks.
With you and me, it starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good.
All righty, welcome back.
Live in harmony.
Our Our first guest today is Chris Fogarty. It's F-O-G-A-R-T-Y. And his book is so all-encompassing. It is very, very incredibly wonderful research. And he talks about prehistoric Ireland, where the people may have come from. It goes way back, and it's a must-have for anybody with any Irish blood. My Irish ancestors came before. They came late 1700s to this country, and so. But it's difficult to do research in Ireland, because, the records have been messed with. But you actually went there. You went to the public record office, which of course is now in England. And
yes, the National Archives. I think perhaps I should mention here that the brother who taught us in school in Castlereagh was approached by an ex-pupil. We both studied under Brother Enda, and he went to him. I had asked my ex-schoolmates to stand up and be a little committee that would receive a memorial that they would maintain and be responsible for, that my wife and I would install. They were all in favor until somehow they all became afraid. One of them took my pamphlet at the time to the brother, the Marist brother who had taught us all, and said, "Brother, have a look at this and tell us what the errors are, where it is mistaken, where it's wrong. We'll be back in 2 weeks." So the kid went back 2 weeks later, and the brother said, "This is all factual." And one of them said to him, "Brother, if you say this work is true, why did you teach us, and that it was a genocide, why did you teach us all famine in school?" And that Maris brother, otherwise very fine, good, hardworking teacher, replied, "I had no choice. I had to use the curriculum as provided to me by the government." So that shocks me that a teacher, knowing the truth, would have lied to a student throughout his teaching career. Another classmate of mine, after I came to the States, he became an excavation contractor. And when there was a decision made to build a housing development on top of the Castlereagh workhouse mass grave, he was excavating in the area outside the toddlers building. There were seven different categories of inmates kept there. Families were split up. Small babies were left with their mothers. Toddlers were kept in a separate one. Boys and girls in another. Men and women in another. All families were split up. So he, as an excavation contractor, excavating for this development of houses, was digging in an area where his backhoe was excavating piles of toddlers, of remains of toddlers. And at the time, he was raising small children himself. And so this shocked him, but he continued working, loading up hundreds or thousands of toddlers' remains into his truck and hauling it away to be dumped. After a few days, the word got out, and the work was stopped, and the number of houses atop the mass grave was reduced in order to avoid the areas where the bodies were thickest. But there were seven different burial grounds within the grounds of each workhouse in Ireland, and there were hundreds of those workhouses in the country. So that's where we are. I'd like to also mention that the book is available from me. My telephone number is 312-664-7651. In Ireland, it's available through the website or blog, billymaguire.com. That's Billy, BillyMcGuire.com. And from Saoirse Newspaper. Saoirse is Irish for freedom. Saoirse Newspaper, 223 Parnell Street in Dublin. Or in Australia, through Jimmy Fury, J-I-M-M-Y-F-U-R-E-Y, Jimmy Fury, @gmail.com in Australia. So there's a source of the books. And also I should mention that on Sunday, April 19th, from noon until 3 p.m., I'll be at the Frugal Muse bookstore in the Chicago southwestern suburb of Darien at 7511.
Oh, really?
Pardon me?
Yes? On what day? April 7th?
April 19th, Sunday, April 19th. The Sunday after Easter.
Okay.
And
I gotta write this down.
Frugal Muse Bookstore at 7511 Lamont Road.
Right.
And there I will go over my book and discuss it with whoever is interested.
Well, I live probably 2 miles from there. Yes, 2 miles.
I've often wondered.
Yes.
Well, that's nice. Perhaps now I also ought to go over just the contents of the book. Chapter 1 is pre-Holocaust Ireland that you referred to. The pre-Holocaust presence of British Army rank and file in Ireland. The third is the Holocaust. The fourth is resistance to the food removal. Fifth is the role of government, churches, and news media. Sixth is the toll of the Holocaust, the number of people murdered. The seventh is the aftermath, the continued coercion acts, land war boycott, the continued evictions. Eight, England repatriates its landlords. Nine, the rent extractions continue.
Chris,
break now?
Yeah, we have to take a real quick break. I've posted information in the chat room about how guests can, or how people can get your,
Very good. Book. Thank you.
Okay, we'll be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad.
All righty, we are back. And our guest, our first guest today is Chris Fogarty. And I was just writing in my calendar, you're going to be at Frugal Moose, April 19th, that's a Sunday, from what time to what time?
At noon to 3, I'm told.
Okay.
Yes, but to continue then, if I may, on the,
yes,
on the contents of the book, just in very, very, skip over it. After the toll of the Holocaust is chapter 6. The next one is the aftermath, the continued coercion acts, land war, boycott. The word boycott originated there from a land agent for an English landlord by the name of Boycott, who raised the rents on the Irish people on their own land to live there, and they decided to shun him. And so it went into the language as boycott, to the shunning of someone, to refuse to work for them, to refuse to deliver their mail, to assist them in any way. And they drove him out of the country in that way. So boycott then was adapted by the very people who had used it in Ireland when they came to the States and became railroad workers and construction workers and miners and different things. So that's how boycott came into the language, from Captain Boycott, an agent of an English landlord in Ireland. But then to continue, the continued evictions. In chapter 9, 11, England repatriates its landlords. It bought them out at above market prices, and they all went back to England where they or their ancestors had come from. But the rent extractions continue. The next chapter 10, the truth tellers. Chapter 11, the cover-up artists and who kept the Holocaust, quote, perfect, unquote. Chapter 12, Speranza. That's the name of a female poet, a wonderful, wonderful woman, versus Sir William Wilde, her husband. And they were the parents of Oscar Wilde, the artist.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And she was Ireland's main opponent of the genocide, the chief outspoken person against it. She was allowed to survive while doing so because she was Protestant of English extraction in Ireland. Anyone else would have been executed. And then her husband was the main empire man in Ireland, and it was he who falsified the 1841, 1851, and 1861 Irish censuses. He was the commissioner of the 1851 and 1861 census and the medical commissioner of the 1841 census. So it was he who completely destroyed the census of those years. Chapter 13 is how to refute the history falsifiers. Chapter 14 is what we must do. Then the back half of the book, the second half of the book, is comprised of exhibits in their legal sense as evidence of the crime of genocide. And the one part of it is the smoking gun map that you mentioned. It showed the location for at least one very lengthy period in Ireland of the specific food removal regiments. And it shows the location of all 67 of them. It shows the locations and photographs of memorials that my wife and I have put up over a number of them. And then exhibits B are sample news reports of food leaving Ireland and arriving in England. There's abundant of that. And then exhibit C are the immediate perpetrators of the Holocaust, the British Army regiments that removed the food, and their provenances, what part of England they came from, their recruitment areas, and the deployment of the Irish-named British Army regiments during those 1845 years. They were kept, the Irish-named regiments were kept out of Ireland in those years. They really should have rebelled, but they were stationed in other parts of the empire. The British Army regiments that did not participate in the food removal, I thought because we're naming all those who did perpetrate that crime, that it would be fair to name those that did not participate. So they're all named also. And then the landlords' militias. Then there were also landlords' militias. They had their own muscle in the form of armed men. And the record of the typical county disembodied, that the reserve militia regiments, the revenue police, the constabulary, their roles, the Coast Guard, the total number of British armed enforcers of the food removal, that's all there. The deployments of and then typical cess seizures. A cess at the time was a tax to maintain the army. So there were cess seizures by the army and by the constabulary. And there's evidence, abundant evidence of those particular sweeps through the country, townland by townland, the number of officers or number of soldiers in each, etc. And then a table of non-potato food processors that were extant during the Holocaust. I'm just going to make a switch over here to just touch on that. At that time in Ireland, while the people were starving to death, at a time when we were all taught in school nothing but potatoes were grown, there were 1,935 corn mills,
wow,
1,984 corn kilns, 555 flour mills, 136 grain-using breweries, 74 grain-using distilleries, 62 threshing mills, even though most of the grain at the time was hand-threshed by flails. There were 948 livestock pounds, and there were 45 woolen mills, indicating the presence of mutton and lamb. And there were 43 windmills, also for grain. So all of those are located, the specific townland in which they were located while the people starved. The whole point of locating all of them and enumerating them is to show that potato had very little to do with the total amount of food being produced in Ireland. It was a relatively small crop, just one of many crops. And so potato famine is a lie. They don't teach potato, at least in my time in Ireland, they did not teach potato famine, because that would be too big a lie. But they did teach famine without really explaining it, why it had happened. And so there's what we were faced with. And then also I list, my book also names all of the landlords, their names and the amount of land they had. They typically had 20 or 30,000 acres of land, each landlord, and they usurped or claimed for themselves all wealth produced by everybody on that land, except starvation wages. They would allow the grass of a cow or two and a couple of acres for a person to grow their own oats or their own potatoes, but they kept the typical Irish agricultural laborer, and all of Ireland was in agriculture like they were at the time here in the States. The Irish worked 260 days a year standard in order to be allowed to live somewhere. And those 260 days a year was on the so-called landlord's crops. And it was actually those crops that were removed at gunpoint legally, according to the law at the time, that were the landlord's property. And they were all, again, English landlords, that they had gotten it by a grotesque coercion of the people, where they say the landlord was also the local justice of the peace, or the local lawyer, or the local minister, and the same landlord who would also be the local minister of the Church of England might also be the judge who would hear any cases on the bench. And so it was a strange situation. You might, anyone who reads my book also will find in it Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal about the commonsensical idea that English people, particularly English landlords, ought to start eating Irish babies, that they have the greatest claim to the babies, having already sacrificed their baby's parents or consumed them. So he was quite a man. So lest anyone think now that all Irish ought to hate all English, let's remember that Jonathan Swift was an English man, and he was an elder in the Church of Ireland. That's the English state church in Ireland. They had the chutzpah to call it the Church of Ireland, even though all of Ireland was 100% Catholic, Roman Catholic, and essentially still are. So we have a strange twisting of history, and the Irish government, strange to say, are behind that twisting. I don't understand why a nation's government would actively conceal a genocide of their own people, and why they would want to harm anyone who tells the truth about it.
That's very difficult for
me to understand.
It's the same in this country. When they federalized education, it's mostly about money. If you want government funds, then you need to follow a certain program of education. And it has all been designed by people who wish to alter the historical facts of a country in order to hide crime.
Yes.
Because when you look at all of the slaughter from the wars that I previously mentioned, if people generally knew about all of this, they would be flabbergasted. But most people get their news from programming. We're all programmed. The government schools are government schools, and they
program us. There was a wonderful Englishman who toured Ireland. He was a farmer in England who paid rent to the local lord, and also hired laborers. So he was a farmer who was in the middle between the landlord and the laborer doing actual work. And he visited Ireland, and he wrote letters back to England, to different lords and people in power in England, and also to his own laborers. And he was saying, if only the English people knew what the lords were doing in Ireland, that they would not permit it, that the English people do not know what their government is doing. And this was before the Holocaust in Ireland. This was in the 1830s that he made his tour throughout rural Ireland. And I must say, he was a most beautiful, beautiful man. So there's another example, you see. We dare not ever, ever use broad brush and say the anybody, because within all ethnic groups, within all nations, there are all kinds of people. But perhaps we ought, before I go forward on the matter of the FBI crimes, I'd like to mention that one day, while we were seven lawyers were sitting around a table discussing our case, our defense against the FBI crimes. And by the way, my wife was out on a $50,000 bond. I was out on a $100,000 bond. It was 10% down, but responsive liability for the nominal amount. We were facing the rest of our lives in prison. So we were in a lawyer's office, and we were the seven lawyers were, we had actually four lawyers, but then each of the three of the four lawyers had supporting lawyers with them. So, and I had hired Ann Burke for our eldest, for our oldest member, Frank O'Neill, because we recognized it was a political case and we thought we would have a political person. Ann Burke is the wife of Eddie Burke, the head of the finance committee of the Chicago City Council. And
wow.
So at a previous meeting, she had gotten my approval to hand over her responsibility to another person who worked in City Hall. I said, that's okay so long as you get the job done. At the next meeting, when all seven lawyers were present, she said, Chris, I just decided that I cannot do what you asked me to do because it would be a violation of ethics. And the lawyer sitting beside her, David Thomas, professor of IIT Kent Law School, ITT Kent Law School, said, no, Ann, you're wrong. It would be a violation of ethics if you fail to perform what you agreed to do. So I had to let her go. We had to fire Ann Burke. But here is the kicker. The law professor who rebuked Ann Burke and saying that it would be a violation of ethics if she failed to perform according to her agreement, he has since been stripped of his license. The honest lawyer has been stripped of his law license, while Ann Burke, that I had to fire for her failure to perform ethically, she's now the head of the Illinois Supreme Court. And, of course, the wife of Eddie Burke, who is facing appropriate charges.
Right.
And so this is a crazy world. And they took away David Thomas's law license by getting to one of his own clients who was well-treated and well-served by David Thomas as a lawyer to say that David Thomas, his lawyer, had not adequately kept the family apprised of the case's progress. That's a mighty small reason to take away a lawyer's law license, his livelihood. But that's what they have done to ex-professor David Thomas. And I grieve for him, and I grieve for American justice that the ethical lawyer has had his license taken away from him, while the corrupt lawyer that he publicly rebuked is now the head of the Illinois Supreme Court. That's justice in Chicago and perhaps the whole nation right now. But onward then to the FBI crimes. After they burst through our door, and there were a number of raids on us, one with 14 different agents, a total of 19 agents crashed through our door here at different times, with drawn guns a couple of times. After we defeated them in the law office of George Lindbergh, that's say in the federal building on Dearborn Street, we defeated them by exposing what they had done. They had criminally fabricated evidence against us. They did also have a witness. They had hired a small-time criminal from Brooklyn, sent him in here to Chicago, and he used to meet us on weekends, and we'd sell books and do different things. And he was supposed to be spying on us. Well, he had bad habits. He kept Patrick Buckley so tied up, springing him from Chicago area lockups that, Buckley must have had no time to do anything else. He was arrested and he sprung from lockups for many times for drunken driving, and twice for the breaking the noses of two women. Once was in a dispute over rent, and the other broken nose was due to the crashing of a car while he was drunk and he was driving. So in court, Judge George Lindbergh, U.S. Judge George Lindbergh, asked FBI agent Buckley about witness JT. I don't want to mention the poor boy's name. It's really a shame. He's JT's whereabouts.
Wow.
He said the last I heard from JT was from a Minneapolis lockup after he had crashed a car he had stolen in Chicago. So that ended one threat to us, because we knew that this witness was another perjurer, And we were freed
we
from the danger
to
of that perjurer by that whole series of crimes perpetrated by the perjurer while he was in Chicago, and when he drove his stolen car to Minneapolis.
Wow,
so,
Chris,
so nothing
we
left
do have
against
to
us
cut to
against
a quick
except
break.
an audio tape. An
And our first guest today is Chris Fogarty, and I'm sorry we had a commercial break, and it was just very. So please pick it up where you left off.
Yes, I think I kept talking through it because I had my earpiece,
and
that's probably connected to my ear. But to continue, the witness against us, JT from Boston, had kept FBI agent Buckley busy springing him from Chicago area lockups many, many, many times, usually for drunken driving, but also for breaking the noses of two women. Once in a rent dispute and the second time in a car crash while he was driving up against the windshield of a car. When the U.S. Judge George Lindbergh asked Agent Buckley for his witness, Buckley said, "The last I heard from JT was from a Minnesota jail cell after he had crashed a car he had stolen in Chicago." So after we proved that the only evidence against us, an audio tape, was a criminal fabrication, and that was proven so by one of Illinois' main most eminent sound engineering laboratories, we walked free after 15 months of hell. We walked free of these false charges. But so did the criminals, and they were deployed to Ireland, and they remained in Ireland from about 1995 until the evening of August 15th, 1998, hours after the murder of 29 people to be blamed like the Langert murders on the IRA. They seem to have achieved that lie in Ireland, and they remained there until demobilized by MI5 email on the evening of the 15th of August, 1998, hours after that massacre. That was evidently mission accomplished. When you walk away from your mission after years on site, evidently it's mission accomplished. So that the murder of the 29 evidently was their purpose in Ireland. They blamed and that did defeat the IRA, and the defeat of the IRA did free up the British Army, and the freed up British Army did allow the neocons to go ahead with their wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. So that's how that happened. But while Agent Buckley was in Ireland, along with others working in conjunction with MI5, he made a trip to the Atlanta Olympics, to the Atlanta bombing murder site. So it was he and his FBI colleagues who framed Richard Jewell. Richard Jewell was a security guard who had noticed the knapsack, moved people away from it, notified the police, and yet the FBI framed him for those murderers. There were two people murdered. David Jewell never saw justice. He died not long after. He had cases against the news media for the framing of him, the same way that Carol Marin had framed me and others for the Langert murders in Winnetka, all
wow.
done at the push by the FBI to disinform the American people as to the supposed threats against the American people. But David Jewell never did see justice. And I had never had a whole lot of knowledge about Eastwood, Clint Eastwood, but he made that film named David Jewell to redeem the reputation of the poor, destroyed Richard Jewell.
Okay, we do have a top of the hour break. We will be right back momentarily. is Christopher Fogarty. He is the author of Ireland, 1845 to 1850.
Oh, that's a big job.
The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It Perfect. And do be sure and purchase this book. I've put the shipping and address and everything where you can get a hold of Chris to purchase this book direct. All righty, let's continue. Are you there?
Oh, yes, yes. I that was a very fast break.
Yeah, it's the top of the hour. And
yes, perhaps I should mention again that at the Frugal Muse, next on the April the, let's take a second.
19th.
On April
19th. Well,
I'll back off and say that my book can be acquired either from me at 312-664-7651. Here in Chicago, and they'll put it in the mail, or in Ireland through BillyMaguire.com, or from Saoirse Newspaper at 223 Parnell Street in Dublin, or in Australia through Jimmy Fury at gmail.com. That's JimmyFurey at gmail.com in Australia.
And you'll be at the Frugal Muse on
Sunday,
19th,
April 19th.
From 12
from
till
noon
3.
To 3. At 7511 Lamont Road,
yes,
in Darien.
Yes, and let's have a late lunch after.
Wonderful.
You're bringing Mary with you, right?
That would be a great pleasure to me and an honor. I've known of you for a long time now, and I must say I consider Deanna Spingola one of America's great patriots. And I know that's a dangerous position for any person to have in a time of the big lie. But I know you're doing it because you must, as I am.
Yes. Yes, I was chatting with Mark, who's a friend of ours, and I said, why don't you join us? And he would love to. I know you talked earlier.
Yes, well, that would be wonderful, indeed.
Wouldn't that be fun? But he lives out of state, but we were trying to figure out how to get him up here, too. That would be just super.
Yes, 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 yes. So purpose here on your show and for which you're giving your time is to make clear that what has been advertised and taught as a famine was in fact a genocide perpetrated by more than half of a nation's army. It took more than half of Britain's army to starve Ireland between 1845 and 1850, 67 regiments of its 130
wow.
regiment army. And and the names of the regiments, their recruitment areas, say the part of England they're from, their recruitment areas are all covered there. And by the way, there was one regiment from the United States. Isn't that interesting?
Really?
Yeah, that would be a loyalist, a group of loyalists from perhaps up around Maine or New Hampshire, somewhere north of Boston, where there was a large number of loyalists, including the Bush family, of course.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, those who, during the American Revolution, according to this British MP, this beautiful man, William Cobbett, that I mentioned earlier, and who toured Ireland in the 1830s, and his letters to England are, Cobbett in Ireland, a warning to England, and it was his contention that if the British aristocrats, or the criminals in power at the time, could continue doing to Ireland what it was doing, that it would eventually do the same thing to the people of England. And they did a whole lot worse in Ireland. They perpetrated genocide in Ireland, but somehow it did not quite transfer over to the English people. He also warned the Scottish about what was being done to the people of Ireland, that their turn would be next if they didn't get rid of a couple of the economists at the time, Malthus and Ricardo, at the time who were promoting more for the rich and less for for the poor. It's a crazy setup, but that's what was going on at the time. But Richard Cobbett was there, and he exemplifies. I wish that more people in the world would learn about that fine Englishman, William Cobbett, a farmer and a British and a member of Parliament. But he described the conditions of the Irish, and oh, by the way, so did, and it's part of my book, so did Gustave de Beaumont. Gustave de Beaumont was a French aristocrat who had previously toured the United States, and they wrote two books. They both collaborated on both books, but only one became the better known, and that is Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville.
All right.
It praises the Americans and has never gone out of print. The other book that tells the dark side of America, again, on which they both worked, is Marie o Esclavitude en les États-Unis, Marie or Slavery in the United States. That book was never even translated into English until 1956. And if only that book had been translated, America could have saved itself an awful lot of suffering and crime and wrongdoing, including official wrongdoing. But that's all under, water that's under the bridge gone by now. But this, in a sense, we must laugh so that we don't cry.
True.
The amount of food that was removed from Ireland at gunpoint is all covered in my book. And it is massive. It is tons and tons and tons and tons on each day's arrivals at various English ports. According to Cobbett, most of the west of England was living on Irish food in the 1830s. And shipments of Irish food actually increased while the population of Ireland was halved. Half the population of the Catholic population of Ireland starved to death in those years or died of malnutrition-induced illness.
And it also provided...
So again, my book shows the location by townland. And by the way, townland in Ireland is not like township in the United States. In Ireland, a townland is the smallest political and postal division, typically 200 or 300 acres. And so it showed that fairly pinpoints the location of every grain mill, of every grain kiln, of every flour mill, of every cattle pound, of every woolen mill, indicating mutton and lamb in the country. And so it makes it quite clear, abundantly clear, that Ireland was overflowing, had a huge amount of food at the time, and yet half the population starved to death in those years. Part of the book shows the Hawkins family crest. The Hawkins was another landlord, and their family crest is of a head and shoulders of obviously an African, with ropes tight around his shoulders and biceps, a very tight rope, and looking very angry. But that is the family crest for that family. They proudly declare the source of their wealth, and the source of their wealth was slavery. They had shipped a few tens of thousands of Irish slaves to the Caribbean. Cromwell started it in about 1653-4 into Jamaica. But there are a number of islands there, and I've been in Montserrat that has a number of Irish place names. They called the Irish Redshanks. They were known by their fellow slaves as Redshanks because they probably all died fairly early of solar radiation. I lived in the tropics myself for some years, and have needed shots of liquid nitrogen every few months for the last 40 years to keep it at bay. But that's solar radiation and how ill-equipped we Irish are to spend much time in the sun.
Right.
Again, the book is available in England, in Ireland, in Australia, and here in Chicago. And it can be bought from me at FogartyC@att.net or at 312-664-7651. or from Amazon. It's also on Amazon.
Oh.
And his title is Ireland 1845-1850, The Perfect Holocaust and Who Kept It, quote, perfect, unquote. So there,
yeah,
there is the, it plows new ground. There is no secondary sources. It all comes from primary sources, and that's what makes, that's what gives it its value.
Right.
It comes from the British government's own records.
Now, how many,
so therefore, I would suggest that anyone interested in history of any kind, particularly Irish Americans, who are probably, well, when I was young, the main jokes were Irish stupidity jokes, Pat and Mike jokes, and it had everything to do with stupidity. I wonder how many children of Irish people in America have not been allocated seats in the different colleges and universities because of their names, the assumption of stupidity. It's a very ugly thing. And later in the 1970s, when they were replaced by so-called police jokes, there was only one of those jokes that I liked, and that was, what's black and blue and lies on the floor? And the answer is, someone who tells police jokes. But
yeah.
Enough of that.
Is there a way of actually telling how many people
died? Do we have another break?
No. Is there a way of telling exactly how many people died as a result of this situation, this five-year period?
Actually 6 years, 45 through 50 is actually 6 years.
Right.
But, yeah, but...
there's no way, is there?
No way to nail it. And because the truth has so many enemies, and because all of my information is actually nailed, absolutely indisputable, I'm not inclined to touch on the exact number, because I'll never have it right. And the fact that that is not quite certain, people would use it to attempt to cast into doubt all of the absolutely documented information.
Right.
I'll mention, however, here that the death to murder toll was written by a Corkman living in England, who spent years on English censuses, so he knows all about censuses. And it's the last sentence in his work, in the 22 pages of chapter 6 in my book, is, who can say that it wasn't 6 million? I think, from my studies, it seems that there were about 5.2 million murdered. But the record has been completely contaminated, essentially destroyed, by Speranza's husband, the father of Oscar Wilde, William Wilde, who was knighted because of his concealment of the Irish Holocaust.
Wow.
If you read, it's too much to go into here now, but he fabricated diseases and gave names to diseases that have never existed and claimed that the Irish had a particular susceptibility to those illnesses. And he attributes, by the way, as explanations as to what caused this mass death of these illnesses, is he reached as far back as 400 and 500 AD to celestial eclipses as possible. In other words, he tries to throw mud and dust and fog and mirrors into the whole thing. But the diseases that he mentions are really quite comical in the names he conjures up for them. And of course, what it all was, starvation and all of the diseases that come from malnutrition.
Right.
And again, approximately 5.2 million people. In 1847 alone, there were some 100,000 came into Canada, and there were only about 40,000 still alive a month later. Oh, there wasn't 100,000 when they arrived in Canada. 100,000 left Ireland. And as they died of diseases coming across the Atlantic, already starving before they left Ireland, obviously, it has been repeatedly written that if each ocean burial were marked with a cross all the way across the Atlantic, that a person could walk across from the top of each cross to the other, all the way across. But then a huge number died in the St. Lawrence River, and within a month of arrival in the various sheds along Montreal and Quebec and Toronto. In Toronto, what is now a cathedral in Toronto, just uphill from the port where they came in, there was a tent city once of people dying, and they were buried in trenches alongside their tents. That's covered in my book also. They were desperate times. Justice needed to be done. But eventually, Ireland got rid of its English landlords between 1900 and 1910, when the British government, facing a more risen Irish people and international outrage by what was being done to the people of Ireland by the British government, that they bought them out, and again at above market prices, so that my father was still paying off that old debt, like all other Irish farmers, into the 1970s. They were still paying that off into the 1970s, that supposed debt to the old English landlords who were bought out between 1900 and 1910. The amount granted to the English landlords of Ireland was so outrageous, so beyond market price, that the repayment period was set at 68.5 years. How often do you hear of a debt that has a repayment period of 68.5 years? But that's what was done in Ireland by the British government.
Wow. And
of course, the map of Ireland is dotted by mass graves from those years. And my wife and I are putting memorials up over those mass graves. And all of the memorials we install name the specific British regiments that stripped that mass grave and its area of the food, of its food production. We named the specific regiments that put those people in those mass graves, those specific mass graves.
Wow. And of course, a lot of people left in order to not starve, and that introduced people into the Irish into this country, where they were used principally as slave labor.
Well, before the Revolution, or in fact up to the Revolution, there were Irish slaves in the United States, in the North American colonies, in Boston and New York and New Orleans and different places, but the Irish were freed. In fact, everyone was freed of slavery, except African Americans, as a result of the 1776-1781 American Rebellion. And so it was a wonderful thing. It was particularly, especially brilliant for the people of Ireland, because they were taken as slaves by the British into the United States, into its British North American colonies. So, and when the British when the Loyalists fled the American forces in 1776 to 1781, and many went to New Brunswick, Canada, according to William Cobbett, who was a soldier there in the British Army at the time, a quarter of a million Loyalists survived in New Brunswick, Canada, on food that was shipped to them from Ireland.
Wow.
That was in 1776 through 1781. And the British general, who surrendered his sword to George Washington at Yorktown, he didn't do it personally, he had his second in command do it, he later became the British viceroy to Ireland and the head of its military forces in Ireland. And he slaughtered the people who rose in 1798, it was a disaster for Ireland. Again, some wonderful Protestants. They were all the leaders. The Irish were so destroyed at the time. They had no weapons. They couldn't have weapons. It was illegal to educate your children in Ireland for a couple of centuries under British rule. It was a felony crime to be a school teacher or to educate your children or to have land, or to receive land, or if someone's child died, you could not educate them. Any orphan had to be educated within the British system. It was a felony crime to attend the religious services of the Catholic faith. It's shocking what goes on. It was referred to by the conservative Edmund Burke as the most ingenious set of laws ever made to degenerate a people. That's close to what he said. But you'd wonder what was on the minds of such people that they would criminalize education. But that's what happened. When they did that, many hundreds of Irish were sent onto the continent for education. But the next queen, Queen Anne, made that a crime also, to send your children overseas for education. So that was foreclosed also. But anyway, all those crimes are in the past. And I must say, part of the reason for my focusing upon the Irish Holocaust is that it is, to this day, a concealed Holocaust. And my hackles are raised, and everyone's hackles should be raised, by the very notion of a concealed Holocaust, a concealed genocide. And that is what has gone on, and that cover-up cannot survive the facts. The facts are so clear, and they're from the perpetrator's own records, that it shouldn't take much longer. I see my wife is on Facebook a lot. Very few people are getting by any longer with talking about the Irish famine. That's now because always there's someone there to correct them, and that correction is coming from people who have read my book or who have heard about my book, and that is very, very gratifying.
Yes, it must be.
And it can be bought on Amazon.com or in Ireland from Saoirse newspaper at 223 Parnell Street in downtown Dublin, or in Australia from Jimmy Fury, that's J-I-M-M-Y, F like Frank, U-R-E-Y, at gmail.com. And what else? And it's from the Irish Republican Brotherhood, or Billy Maguire, at Billy Maguire, M-C-G-U-I-R-E, BillyMaguire.com in Dublin. So the book is available. Do learn about it. Learn the facts. There is absolutely no need for any embarrassment about the failures of our ancestors. They were not stupid. They did not fall into a lethal trap of their own making. They did not grow only one failure-prone crop. They were robbed of their labor by the government of the time, and there was nothing they could do. They had no weapons. They had been deprived. They had been disarmed by the very government who was destroying them. And that's why, to this day, I'll always be in favor of the Second Amendment of the United States.
Oh, me too, absolutely.
It is the last bulwark we have against a government gone completely corrupt. The American people really must be armed. We must do also something about guns in the wrong hands, but the American people need to be armed in order to maintain American freedom.
Wow. Yes. I agree with you totally. And I've posted the, where they can, I've posted information about your book.
I can barely
in the
hear
chat
you.
Room. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah. I'm
I
here.
I can barely hear you.
Oh, I'm here.
Okay, good. So where are we now? On the matter of the FBI crimes, the most recent one that I know of, perpetrated by FBI agent Patrick, quote, Ed, unquote, Buckley, was against Richard Jewell. And Richard Jewell never did. He's a security guard who found the bomb backpack at the Atlanta Olympics and
right.
Warned people away from it and notified the police. And yet when the FBI arrived from Ireland, when Buckley arrived from his mission in Ireland, he and his fellow FBI colleagues framed Richard Jewell, the heroic security guard, for those murders. And Richard Jewell then sued the newspapers who had done what the FBI had asked them to do and blame him. But he died before ever seeing justice. And it's my understanding that is what motivated Clint Eastwood to make the film Richard Jewell, to redeem the reputation of the man whose reputation had been destroyed by the FBI, while the FBI kept the actual murderer at large for indefinitely. Eric Rudolph, the actual murderer, was at large for a very long time as a consequence of the FBI's framing of an innocent man.
Wow.
The same way that FBI agent had kept murderer Richard Biro, B-I-R-O, at large for 6 months after murdering the Langert family in Winnetka by getting Carol Marin in the Chicago news media to blame the murderers or link it to the IRA and then focusing upon me and then framing me for it. All of that kept the murderer at large for 6 months. All these crimes perpetrated by the FBI evidently are untouchable. Nothing can be done about the crimes.
Wow.
And no news media in Chicago will touch them. On the day that we were about to have the FBI crimes exposed in federal court in front of Judge George Lindbergh, Mary and I went to the press office on the same floor as Judge Lindbergh's courtroom. And there we begged the news media to come and to see what was about to happen. They had reported on the charges against us. They had gone through all the stuff that the FBI had wanted them to do. But when it came down to the facts of the matter, the proof that the evidence against us was a criminal fabrication, they refused to leave the press office and walk the few doors down the corridor to the courtroom and observe what was taking place. And yet, and Matt O'Connor of the Chicago Tribune was one of them, and I must say, because of his name, I focused on him. I pleaded with him. And yet he had a report in the following day's Chicago Tribune that essentially repeated the charges against us.
Oh.
He refused to tell the truth about what was there of it. He refused to walk down the corridor. So what Chicago reporters are doing, like Eric Zorn and John Cash and so many others, John Cass, who are supposedly other consciences of the Chicago news media, they carefully protect their, quote, innocence, unquote. They do not want to learn anything that might expose official crime.
Of course, right. And if you don't listen to anybody that wants to tell you the truth, then you have a reason, an excuse. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, there. That's where we are.
So what we now have
is an American population who, many of like me, who from the press, we go to the Guardian newspaper, the old Manchester Guardian,
right.
Now the Guardian newspaper in England, to find out, for example, that the Holman Square dark site exists. No Chicago newspaper will tell us that, but the Guardian newspaper in Manchester, England, will inform Chicago about it. And we have that situation. And I'm not particularly promoting English journalism or British journalism, but we must be clear when facts are clear, we must mention those facts. And Chicago and the United States is essentially, except for people like yourself, and you are a jewel in the whole nation, and I don't know how many more there are. There are very, very few, but you're there, Deanna, and I must say you are a jewel in the crown of the United States of America, and it would not be the same country if you were not here. And what's more, if it is being saved at all, it is being saved by you and people like you, and you're in such a small minority that I know that you're in danger, because I know what is being done to others of American heroes. They're in prisons. They're in federal prison in the United States, or they're being held in foreign prisons at the demand of criminals in the United States government. So we have a situation now where criminals in the United States government is threatening legal action and is legally imprisoning people who tell the truth. These are strange times, and I don't see them getting worse. I really do think that they're going to get better quite soon, because they won't be able to. They trade in lies, and they depend upon lies. And I don't think their lies can withstand the truth on a permanent basis.
Well, with your book certainly, it's very scholarly, and certainly exposes what happened in Ireland. And if people only took the opportunity to read and educate themselves, it would be so much better. So much better. Okay, we are going to a short 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and as I mentioned, I'm Irish. I'm Irish, English, Danish, and German, and
a real American.
Right, and so my Irish ancestors came over early. My maiden name is Burks, B-U-R-K-S, and it's a when I was doing family history research, it was very difficult because, with all the destruction and the, I wanted to go forward with it rather than go back because they came over so early. But it was very difficult to do, just as research in the South is very difficult to do. Anytime that you've had a large destruction of property and records and that kind of thing, it always makes research very difficult, which is why your book is so incredibly outstanding and important, because you have researched the history of a period that would exemplify earlier periods of time where people were leaving, but your research is impeccable. It really is. It is remarkable. And I'm so glad that you wrote your book, that you didn't let yourself be intimidated by people, and that you've continued to talk about this. I'm grateful to both you and Mary for what you've done, in Ireland because even though my ancestors left previous, and weren't in one of those mass graves, I'm really very impressed with your work.
Well, thank you very much. I must say, I'm very careful to stay strictly with primary research.
Right.
In order to, because I'm speaking for the murdered millions.
Right.
To speak for a murdered people who never had a chance to speak when they were alive and who have been smeared, slandered in death ever since, one must speak accurately for them. And there can be nothing personal, nothing exaggerated, no twisting of facts. What's in the book is strictly British government's own records. I'd like to mention here that all of these FBI crimes against us, and we never did know why, all 7 of our attorneys said they were, after we got rid of Ann Burke because of her lack of ethics, we still had 7 because we had to replace her. In any event, all 7 of our attorneys had, as the case progressed, we learned we were going to absolutely win this because we found that the only evidence against us, an FBI audio tape, had been criminally fabricated. Once that was clear, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I asked our attorneys if they would take our case for damages. All 7 agreed to do so. But after we defeated them and we were completely in the clear and the only crimes had been perpetrated by the FBI, all 7 of those attorneys, by letter to us, through one of the attorneys speaking for all, Pat Tuitt, declined to take the case. And his reason doesn't stand up. And so you wonder, his letter is more like is more like Matt O'Connor, the Chicago Tribune's Matt O'Connor refusal to walk down the few steps to report on something or to observe something that he was going to falsely report on, that he proved that he did indeed falsely report on. You'd wonder, why were all these attorneys so fearful? And the point I'm going to make, however, is that to this day, my wife and I seek an attorney who is both competent and courageous, who will stand up for the law of the United States. These were blatant crimes. They were proven to be blatant crimes. And yet no lawyer in America, as well as no news media in America, other than yourself and a few more, will report these. And no lawyer will take a case that would ordinarily yield a few million dollars in legal fees alone, as the one-third of the award given. So there's something wrong, and we're hoping that some lawyer in America, some attorney, will make it right by standing up for the United States, by standing up for the law. And if they will contact me, Chris Fogarty, I would be more than grateful. But this is for justice and for the United States of America, and we're looking for patriots to stand up. We're sick of criminals, and we're sick of the sheep who go along with crime because it's in their personal interests to go along with crime. And we're asking for a lawyer who will not go along with crime, but who will stand up for law, for justice, and for the United States. So please reach me at 312-664-7651 or through Deanna or any other way you can, because we seek justice. There were a whole series of crimes, and the crimes began only upon the failure of a major smear campaign against me and my wife. That went on for a year and a half or so, and when that didn't stop us, and we at the time we got the McBride principles enacted into law in the state of Illinois, Chicago City Ordinance, and the U.S. Congress. We were only participants in the U.S. Congress. It was nationwide then. That plus the exposing of the British genocide of Ireland must be the only reasons that they singled us out. We have no idea otherwise, because we were never charged with anything we were actually doing. I never murdered the Langert family. I had never heard of them. I had never heard of the murderer in my life. All of that was complete fabrications, crimes by the FBI. But it wasn't just a cowboy FBI agent. We have a letter that was given to us fairly recently by a lawyer, written by the U.S. Department of Justice, and the name is on it, directing the Winnetka police to wrongfully make a federal case out of a state murder charge. And why that was done, we don't know. It's one more indication that the crimes were being fabricated at a level above the FBI. And the FBI were merely lower-level criminals in a major criminal operation. But we do know that they led to the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, etc. So that much we do know, and we've got proof of that also. So that's what they were leading to. And then the murder of the 29 people in Omagh, again, was to defeat the IRA. It did defeat the IRA. That defeat of the IRA freed up the British Army from Ireland, and that freed up army allowed the United States and the neocons to go ahead with their wars in the Middle East. That is the sequence of events, and that explains, is the only explanation that I have. Nothing else makes any sense whatever, but we've got evidence which indicates that each of those steps was dependent upon the other, and that is the actual case.
I think that people are afraid to stand up for the truth because they see the example of other people, such as yourself or even President Kennedy, who was assassinated, for speaking out and for the things that he intended to do. And that's a big public statement that would frighten anybody from taking a case such as yours or from wanting to place themselves in jeopardy.
Yes, in our case, by the way, there's no risk involved other than the risk of criminal activity on the part of the federal government, because the case has already been made. The only question is the amount of the compensation.
Oh, okay.
All that has to be decided, because there is no doubt about the fabrication of the evidence again. That was already proven in court.
Okay.
The fact that I was not the murderer of the Langert family was made clear when David Biro, someone I had never heard of, was imprisoned for it. So,
okay.
So the basis damages for the compensation, all the bases are already set up, officially proven, and so all that remains to be done is to get the judgment for the amount of compensation.
Right.
That shouldn't take a whole lot of courage. No one would have to go out and make the case of the crimes.
Right.
The cases have already been made.
Hmm.
However, one case remains unmade, and that is the murder of the 29 people that allowed the neocons to go ahead with their wars. That murder of those 29 to be blamed upon the IRA, that wrongdoing remains in effect. The blaming of the IRA remains in effect in the way that they didn't get away with when they blamed the IRA for the Langert murders. They didn't get away with that. But so far they have gotten away with the blaming the IRA for the OMA bombing, murder of 29. It was, after all, an IRA bomb. But the people who delivered the bomb would never know why the parking places were all filled in the way they were, and why they had to park in an unusual place. Now, all of that was, they would never, to this day, they might not understand. You see, obviously, with MI5 and FBI involvement, the bomb car going into Omaha County, Tyrone, was being satellite surveilled. The bomb car belonged to an Irish government agent by the name of Paddy Dixon. So the bomb car was satellite surveilled. They knew where it was every inch of the way it traveled. And that enabled them to decide what parking places to leave open or close. And that changed everything. That resulted in the murder of 29 people, and the IRA knew it was their bomb. That couldn't be denied. But what made it different was the control of the parking places. It was a very cunning piece of work, and it did result in the freeing up of the British Army from Ireland, and therefore the neocons, who couldn't go to war without at least one fairly significant army. And they couldn't move forward. The British Army made it possible. They couldn't have done it without the British Army. The British Army was the only real component of what became the fictional international community. The international community is the name under which it was done. All those supreme crimes were perpetrated against Iraq, etc. But it couldn't have happened without an actual army. And the British Army did control southern Iraq at the time, down around so there we have all these crimes. The one in Ireland cannot be proven. Well, it can, actually, by simply getting the people together who perpetrated it and going into the records, the satellite surveillance records of the bomb car. All that's doable, but no one in Ireland wants to do it. Meanwhile, here in the States, the FBI crimes are a matter of record. They're a matter of record, indisputable record of FBI crimes. So the amount of compensation is all that remains to be determined. And we're looking for a lawyer who will take our case for compensation. Mary and I are the only two survivors of the so-called Chicago Four at the time. The other two are now dead. One was old enough, perhaps, to die, but one died young. In fact, being framed by the FBI seems to be a life-shortening experience. One of the four of us was 51 when he died, and Richard Jewell was in his 30s when he died, framed by the FBI. And I've seen of others who have died young, whether they died naturally or for some other reason, but they tend to, anyone who is attacked in any way by the FBI tend to have shorter lives. Mary and I are living on decently, but I must say we could live a whole lot better if we were to be compensated for the amount of damage done to us by those crimes. And we wonder what has gone wrong with American justice that these crimes can be perpetrated with not alone legal impunity, but also covered up by the news media. Where is the Fourth Estate? Where are the people who are supposed to be keeping America safe? And I'm not talking about the military. I'm talking about the news media. Where are they? So, again, if there's any lawyer
indeed.
Around, any attorney with any conscience, then who has, but with enough courage, a case of millions of in terms of a fee awaits them in our case. The case is made. It's what they call a slam dunk case, and we're asking any lawyer to take that case. But the previous lawyers who successfully defended us, in fact, they had to do so. I had presented them with the proof that the audio tape had been criminally fabricated, and that was, once that was undeniable, they then got a sound engineering laboratory to prove it. And so all that's there. In fact, I think I sent it on to you. The 9-page report, page
right.
6 of it, show that on the tape are other statements that prove FBI perjury. Also, it also proves FBI perjuries. So all these crimes are there available to any lawyer who would want to uphold the law for the United States. And so far, my wife and I are quite aware that the United States government is a criminal operation. And we would like the United States, and we're hoping that the United States will become a country of a nation of laws once again. We think it was at one time. We always thought it was. In fact, when FBI agent, we got a warning that the crimes were about to begin. An old schoolmate of mine, FBI agent Joseph Doyle, warned us that the crimes were about to begin. We found it hard to believe him. We couldn't grasp the notion of a criminal FBI agency. But what he warned us about started happening just a few weeks later with the murder of the Langert family in Winnetka, Illinois, by David Biro, B-I-R-O, who's now serving life without possibility of parole in Pontiac, Illinois. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for a lawyer or law firm to take a slam dunk case, an easy peasy case for justice. And again, and those who want to buy my book on the starvation of Ireland, the genocide, the Holocaust of Ireland of 1845-1850, I'll be at the Frugal Muse at 1511. Is it?
It's in the little shopping center, right at, let's see.
7511.
Right.
Lamont Road. Right. 7511 Lamont Road in Darien.
Right.
So I'll be there from noon until 3. And
right.
The book is about the starvation of Ireland. All the perpetrating regiments are named. All of the amount of food in Ireland is all quantified. The amount being removed from Ireland and shipped to England and elsewhere is there, available to anyone. The mass graves, the resultant mass graves, 180 of them are located. So it's available. Another break?
Yes, we'll be right back. Back with our guest, Chris Fogarty, and I invite
you to
visit his website, and the website is, let me get this absolutely correct, is irishholocaust.org. His book is available. I will post the information on how to order it in the website, in the chat room, and there are other venues that you can get the book from that he has mentioned, and of course he will be at Frugal Muse in Darien on the 19th of April, and anyway, it's a must-read book, and it is, if you're into history at all, which everybody should be, because history is prologue. If you want to know what's going on in your country today, or in any country, you have to look and see what has gone on in the past and recognize that the tactics are different, similar, but a little bit different, and the same kinds of people are in charge. And so, anyway, we have a couple of minutes.
Yes. So that will be on Sunday, April 19th, from noon to 3 at the Frugal Muse at 7511 Lamont Road. That's a bookstore in Darien. 7511 Lamont Road.
Yes. And you're going to have some books there. And hopefully you have a big turnout and that people in the area will support you and buy a book. Whether from you,
and also visit the Frugal Muse on their own. Paul Garrison will be very happy to provide you. And I must say, he has a tremendous variety of books there.
Oh,
it's really
amazing.
One tremendous bookstore.
Oh, it's
and
amazing.
So we're looking forward to it. And meanwhile, I'm trying to speak on behalf of the murdered millions. It's a tremendous responsibility because they were not alone murdered; they were slandered in death for 170 years. And
exactly.
This is the first time in by any means that the truth is being told for them. And this book, it completely refutes, demolishes all famine books, Irish famine books ever written. Compared to this real book, Irish famine books are a form of pornography. I call them famine porn. They're disgusting.
Yeah.
Love amid the skeletons. It just makes absolutely no sense. And the people who do that should be ashamed of themselves. And they're all doing it for profit. They're appealing to Irish self-respect by telling stories about the stupidity of the Irish people conjured out of their own stupid brains. Meanwhile, they're covering up a genocide of their own relatives. And they're too stupid to realize it. And we're asking people to please get the facts, learn the facts of history. It's available. If you don't want to go to London to find out from the British National Archives for yourself, read the book. My information comes from all of it comes from official records. And I want to thank you very much for this time. And I hope we've done some good.
Thank you, Chris. Talk to you soon. Okay, we'll be right back.
Bye-bye.
Bye.